Claude Ramsey, President, Mississippi, AFL-CIO.
You remember when George Wallace in 1948 stayed at the convention when the Alabama delegation walked out?
Yes, when they, all the southern states did, yeah. Mississippi included, you know.
And you think?
I thought that would be an interesting thing for you to investigate when you get into Alabama. Now, you know, Wallace began his political career really as a southern liberal or a populist, however you wanted to find it. He was very liberal on economic issues. And he got into the state arena, made his first race for governor. Patterson over there defeated him. He was attorney general at that time. And he defeated him by using the race question. And Wallace said at that time, that's the last time he'd be out niggered in a campaign. And so he embarked on his, find his out if you haven't already, 1961. Well, let's see, I was elected president of this organization in 59 the first time.
And you've been serving continuously since
right,
then?
Right, since 59. In 1960, we sat down and decided what it was going to take to put a program together to turn Mississippi around. The end result of all that was we took a look at all of the state's operations, what they were doing politically, and spent some time in Alabama, Louisiana. I think I went to Arkansas. But after looking over the Louisiana operation, well, I decided that they had the best blueprint for success of any of the state organizations. And so in 61, in a special convention, we adopted a program of progress, we called it, and began to build a program similar to Louisiana. It basically provided the money to do necessary things, you know, mailing some membership, set up a complete mailing system, and the whole works. I'll run you by the office there too, I'll let you see how it's set up over there. The key to success in politics is a couple of distinguished members of the Senate there, is communication, getting the message out to the membership. And the cheapest way and the only way to do it is by mail, you know.
In the 13 years that you've had that program now, did you meet your goals? How successful were you?
Well, we've been fairly successful, much more than a lot of people would think. Of course, we've had a number of things happen in Mississippi that's had a bearing on some of these successes now. I'd say you've got about, let's see, three prominent factors, I think, that's had several things that's happened, some that we had control over and some we didn't. Reapportionment of the legislature's had a very definite thing. One day he'll do something with real brilliance, and the next goddamn day he screws the whole thing up.
Yeah.
I tell you the damn truth, he's been in office this long and I haven't fully made up my mind what the hell we do have any. And I think just about everybody else feels the same damn way about it.
Carl,
you don't have that thing on, do you? They're taping all this, are you?
When the man gets up in the morning, it's a whole new world.
You find Walla an enigma?
Well, he's, you know, the guy had promises of making the state a real great governor. He had everything going for him. And a lot of people want to see him succeed. I haven't frankly given up on it completely yet, but Sway's done some stupid things, you know. When I was way to offend two members of the legislature. And just so many things that make damn sense at all from a practical point of view, you know. But he's a damn breath of fresh air compared to some of these bastards we've had in the past. You know, starting with Ross Barnett in 1960, when I was first on the scene here. I was elected president in 59, and he was one of the first jobs I was faced with as president of the organization was sticking a committee to interview candidates for governor. And I had the pleasure of meeting him and interviewing him at that time, Ross Barnett. That was the beginning of my career in labor movement at state level with Mr. Ross Barnett.
How'd that interview go?
Well, I still remember parts of it now. I was amazed at the the lack of knowledge this guy had of state government, you know, was really amazed. I didn't consider myself being a student of state government. I'd be damned if I didn't have more knowledge about the affairs of state government. He just went in as president of the state fed, and he did, and he was a candidate for governor. I remember one distinct bit of conversation we had. And he had a state senator with him, and he's still over there. Tommy Brooks is still in the Senate. But we had one question. We asked him about compulsory school attendance. Would he be in favor of reenacting a compulsory school attendance? And he looked at me and says, "Why, well, we have such a law in the books already." Brooks nudged me and he said, "Oh, we don't, Governor." He said, that was repealed in 1958. That was part of the segregation package under J.P. Cole. Just two, you know, year before. That'd been repealed over a year when we had that interview. He's a candidate for governor and doesn't know that the proposed school attendance law.
Have they reinstated it yet?
Not yet.
Did you ask him about race in that interview?
No, race wasn't discussed. It was, you know, mostly economic issues. Of course, you remember at that time, 1959, blacks, very few blacks were registered, if I remember right, about 25,000 blacks on the books. So the role that the black played in politics at that point and up until this last election, I guess, was on a negative basis. The Negro was, you know, scapegoat, Whippetmore. The guy can all nigger the loudest is the guy that usually won the election. That's the kind of politics we had, you know, then.
You think that's changed now?
Oh, yes, no question about it. Mississippi is probably undergoing more change in the last, the Voting Rights Act was passed in 65. 74, that's 9 years now, right? We had one, I think the election before this last one, John Bell Williams defeated William Winter, the present lieutenant governor. I think that was probably the last racist type campaign we had. This last one was a completely different kind of a situation. You got something like 300,000 blacks on the books now, and that does make a difference, you know, in the state election campaign. A lot of people just damn well don't believe there's been as much change in this state as there has been. David wrote it out a column in the Washington Post that was reprinted in the other Democrat Times just this past week about that. Did you read it?
Yeah. You think the issue is gone, or is it just below the surface and somebody pushes the button, you're going to have it again?
No, I don't. I don't say that it's gone. Hell, we still got, you know, racist type politicians. We got a number of them in the legislature. You can see undertones of it every now and then, but it's nothing like it used to be. And it's not the overriding issue it once was, you know.
How many members in the AFL-CIO in Mississippi?
We got somewhere in the neighborhood of between 85 and 90,000 members in Mississippi now.
As a percent of the workforce, is it increasing or decreasing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, oh, yeah. That's one thing. We're not at the bottom of the totem pole here in Mississippi is on the percent of the workforce organized. We had a number of states, percentage-wise. We had both the Carolinas on the same page. We've made a lot of growth. That's what I was telling you about some of the things that happened. I started off to tell you about the reapportionment of the legislature had a definite bearing on the situation. Increased black restoration, then the progress we made in organizing. In 59, when I was elected the first time, we had something like 40,000 organized workers. We more than doubled that during this period of time. And this growth has come about in many of the tough areas of the state, you see, many, many areas. And what we've been attempting to do, and I guess this is what you really want to get into, the political alignments that we're trying to develop as a political alignment of sorts with organized labor and blacks as being the basis of the coalition, have been fairly successful in some areas. Not as successful as I'd like to see, you know. But, well, in this last election, to give an example, as a result of a lot of our activities, and that it all ties together, we now have a majority in both houses of the legislature we have put over there. Majority in both houses, Senate and the House. And, well, I had dinner last night with some of the young Turks over there, young progressive-minded House members, you know. And this is one of the things we were talking about there last night. None of them had been around the place, of course, very long. We had two of them in Ed that was serving his second term, three that were in their first term. We were talking about, I was talking with them about the big change in the legislature since 1960, comparing the legislature in 1960 with the present legislature, you see. And I couldn't believe some things had happened that I told them had happened over there. I was here when the Meredith thing occurred. See, that was in 62. And that was something really to behold at that time. You know, the state just went apeshit at that point. Political leadership, you know. They adopted all kinds of bills and resolutions over there, which, you know, with Barnett as governor. Going at damn Capitol, and you'd think it's getting ready to secede any minute, you know. All that's changed now. Of course, it's true, we only got one black face in the legislature right now. But that one black face has made one hell of a difference in the atmosphere and the way people conduct themselves and that whole thing over there. You know. That might be a good idea to meet that guy while you're in the state. You don't have him on your list, huh?
We spent 2.5 hours with him today.
Good man. He's a good man. I don't think we could have found a better black person to broke the ice on the situation. He's very intelligent. He handles himself real well. He's not a knuckle-tongue, but he's not overly pushy, you know. He knows how to work with the people over there. He's well-respected. You'll find this, I think, by most of the members of the House over there. Have you talked to many members of the legislature yet?
Quite a few.
Have you? Have you found this to be true? Most cases? Because we have put him in there. We have put the organization together and financed his campaign, the whole thing.
You say you put half the members in both houses.
We've got a majority in both houses. We have to elect, yeah, this last year.
You helped in their campaigns.
Right.
With money and organization.
We supported, right.
Do you make actual campaign contributions to legislative candidates?
Oh, yeah, sure.
What is it? What would it average out at?
Oh, I don't know. It, of course, varies from district to district. The needs might be greater in one district than it is in another. And the candidate might need more help in one district than another. But I would say, in years in the past, it would run $400 or $500, something like that, actual contributions to the candidate. And then, of course, organization, and I don't count the organization and help get the vote out and stuff like that. I'm talking about the actual money put in the hands of it.
Now, how about legislators from areas where there's really very little in the way of organized labor?
Well, Bob Clark would fit that category. He's out of a rural type county, farming mostly, a large majority black population. We spent a lot of time and money in helping get those people registered, you know, and then helping put the organization together to get the vote out. Very few labor union members in his county. This is what I'm talking about, you see.
How about white members in rural areas?
White members? Well, we've got, in some counties, a strange situation here. You'll find, get up in the, you familiar with the state at all?
A little bit.
You know where Starksville is? The,
yeah.
The side of Mississippi State. Just north of that town of West Point. Give you an example. That's just one. Of course, you've got Kosciuszko over, further over in central part of the state would also fit that category, where they've got one or two sizable industries working, you know, 7, 8, maybe 1,000 people, 700, 8,000 people. Organized plants, and those people live and commute and all over the place, you know, right in the work. So, you know, they maintain their homes in the rural areas. Well, members. And, well, might cite yourself a place like that, but these are the areas that we've been fairly successful in, you know.
What does the state headquarters here get per member for operating expenses?
20 cents a member a month.
20 cents a month.
That's kind of an average figure compared to other states. Louisiana's probably got the highest per capita of any of them. I think Alabama's on about 20. South Carolina hasn't got into this thing as much as some of the states have. I don't remember what their per capita is. North Carolina, I think, went up on theirs a while back, didn't it? What's it, about 20?
Forgot what North Carolina. I think South Carolina just went up to 15.
Yeah, I was thinking that.
Now, can that be used for contributions?
Dues money?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we spend dues money in a state election. So far, we've been successful. We haven't, let's put it this way, we haven't had a law passed prohibiting expenditures of to a dues money in a state election. You can't spend dues money in a federal election, you know. At least not give it to the candidate who uses campaign expenses.
Do most of the candidates that you invite before your committee to for the interview, do they come?
Oh, yeah.
Do most of them want your endorsement or are they reluctant to get one?
Yeah. In recent years, they've been... they've been very anxious for our support.
Is that a change?
Oh, yeah. Right. Like several years back, they looked upon Labor's endorsement more or less as a kiss of death because we didn't have enough members and influence to deliver much of a vote. But that's all changing. Fortunately, I think you probably found this in your interviews with people elsewhere. It's important, I think, you consider the structure of the labor movement and how we operate. And we have these central labor councils in the different areas who actually interview the candidates, we'll say, for the legislature and make recommendations. Then our office works with those people. Of course, we provide them with, records of the candidates, how they're voting on issues, and help them judge the candidate when they make the recommendations. And we do the mailings for them. We prepare the campaign literature in our office. And make some contributions to the candidate, but in most cases that's done through our local labor organizations. We got about I think it's 14 of them scattered around the state. There'll be several counties in one particular CLU. I'm sure you run into this elsewhere, haven't you?
Roughly what percentage of your membership is black?
I estimate about a third. And that percent's growing all the time. Industry is a matter of necessity about as much as anything else, having to hire more blacks. Of course, the Equal Opportunities Act forced them to hire more blacks. But
in most states, there's sort of been a record of blacks being showing more interest in voting for unions and union elections.
Same thing happens here. I was going to tell you, one of the reasons we've been, the success we have in recent years in winning elections, organizing plans. Many of those can be attributed to the fact that the black ratio has increased considerably. And I experience events something like this. If we got a plant that's got, I'd say, 40-50% black workforce under 30, those people will just about organize, But if you find a workforce that's middle age, around 40, predominantly white,
most
for some
black
reason or another, they don't organize.
Most of those blacks are separate
units. No, they're not separate units at all.
They have any problems?
Sir?
Any problems with that?
If we've got any, I don't know about them. We've got most all of our unions, as Mississippi like ever pays out, for many years when we organized people prior to 64, I guess would be the they were organized into separate local unions, separate charters. But all of these segregated locals were abolished several years ago and merged into one union. If we've got any of that left, I don't know about it,
I've been told, Mr. Ramsey, that in Mississippi, at the height of the Klan activity, that in some of those counties, a lot of the Klan leadership came from the union leadership.
Well, I've heard that. I've heard that also, and I don't know that there's any way of proving that we had any leadership that was active in the Klan. I know that we had some people that were members that could be identified as Klansmen. I know that down in the Natchez area we had some of that, quite a bit of that. But if any of the leadership was involved in Klan activities, this is kind of off the record here. I had a meeting with Roy Moore, the FBI, back not long after they set up the headquarters here, and asked him to help me find out if we had any of this. I provided them with the names of our leadership. See, I was on the list of the Klan to be knocked off one time myself, and I wanted to find out who the hell in our own ranks might be identified with this crowd, you see. We didn't uncover any of the leadership of the right demand.
When did you have that experience of being on the Klan list?
In the 60s, early 60s, middle 60s.
What led up to that?
Well, I was active in quite a bit of biracial activity. I was one of the few.
You're telling us about that?
Well, I, back in the, my problems really began in 62. Real problems. They all had racial overtones, with the mayor of the situation. That was the beginning of it all. And I had to start standing up for what was right. And, of course, became the target of all the extremist groups around the state, Just a few white people at that point was stand up what they believed in or thought was right. And of course, I was active in a lot of biracial activity at that point. This kind of thing you talk about was head of the Council on Human Relations. Well, I had to organize that organization before Ken ever come to Mississippi. And we used to meet out at the Tougaloo campus out here. And of course, at that time, anybody that went out to Tougaloo and met with blacks, they were automatically put on the list, And all this type of activity, caused this crowd to zero in on me, what I'm talking about.
But what kind of threats did you get? The phone, written?
Oh, yeah. Just about anything you want to talk about.
Any crosses burned in your yard?
No, strangely enough, I never had a cross burned in my yard. They threatened me with that a couple of times, and I remember telling one of them, this is before I moved up here. I was living on the coast then, and I was to commuting back and forth to Jackson a lot. My family's still down there. A couple of boys, one of them was like 15, and the other was 16. And they were threatening me with that kind of crap then, and I told them that, you know, all I wanted is a couple of seconds notice. I said, I've already instructed my boys if they're hearing the noise around the house to shoot and ask questions later. And I said, if you want your brain blowed out, just come on around and we'll accommodate you. Never did have too much trouble out of them. I've, you know, been threatened.
How'd you feel when you got those threats?
How'd I feel like that? Well, you know, for some strange reason or another, never did bother me too much. See, I'm a veteran of World War II, and I went through some pretty hectic years then. And I just, my philosophy is very simple, that I have to fight a damn war to preserve this damn country, and I wasn't going to let some riffraff tear me from what I thought was right, you know. And that was my attitude. I'm not trying to say I was all that damn brave about the situation, but the type of people that you're dealing with there, they're not going to take you on head on anyway. I found out the best way to deal with them is to tell them in no uncertain terms where you stood and what they could expect, you see. I carried a double barrel shotgun or with buckshot around in my car for a long time for protection. You know what I'm talking about. And I let them know that I'd take at least two of them with me when they come after me, you know.
Is it hard to believe that's about 10 years ago?
Yeah, it really is. It really is. Anybody that been around this long, just like some of these young guys in the legislature, they just damn well didn't want to be. Some of these things happened just that short time ago. Now, we had a white minister here, and Ken Dean can probably fill you in on this, son. This was after he came to Mississippi. Unitarian minister who was active in the Council on Human Relations, who was the secretary for the thing at that time. They shot him in the back over here in the parking lot of the Magnolia Towers one night, and I got a call shortly after that, and advising me to be extremely careful that I was the next guy on the list. The thing that I used to worry about more than anything else during that period was my family. And the fact they might bomb my house, you know. That's the thing that bothered me more than what they might do to me, you know.
Did you ever think of leaving?
No. It's the last thing I intended to do. There were some people who did leave, but I decided, you know. Well, when I was elected president of the organization, I felt that the only organization of any significance in this state could provide the motivating force, the necessary troops to get the job done was the labor movement. You take the labor movement out of the picture, what did you have left, you see? Does that make sense to you?
You mean white organization?
Yes, sir. Predominantly white at that time. That's the thing that a lot of people haven't understood yet. And the thing that you have to think about, and what I pointed out to some other people, the reason that I'm still around today, centered around the fact that we had a hell of a lot of other white people that felt as I did about this whole question, you know? Enough of them stayed with me that we got this whole thing turned around, you know.
What was your relationship with the legislature then, and what is it now?
Well, we didn't have very much influence in the legislature at that time. Very little bit at that particular point, you know.
Would members even prefer just to avoid being seen with you?
Or oh, yeah.
Welcome?
Sure. We only had two or three over there when I was elected. First time that we could consider friendly. Remember when right to work was passed? We had the right to work was passed in 1952, the first time. Put into the Constitution in 1960 when Barnett was governor. That was the first year I was on the job. And if I remember right, we had, I think it was 7 votes against the thing in the Senate and a dozen or so in the House. You know, that's. That just gives you an indication about the little influence we had in the place. And, rough period.
Are you working for agency shop, Bill Hill?
No, we hadn't got to that yet. We got a lot of other things that we have to do.
Does Mississippi have a minimum wage law?
No. We don't have a State Department of Labor. Probably the only state left in the nation, I guess, it doesn't have a Department of Labor.
And these kind of, what are the others that are?
Where is the unemployment, where is the Employment Compensation Act administered?
Unemployment or workman's comp?
Unemployment.
Well, it's a, you know, unemployment is a hybrid type thing with federal and state involvement. And we got a state employment security agency that administers the act. And that's what I was talking to Golson about a few minutes ago. We got a bill tied up conference now that would increase the weekly benefit.
But it's a separate agency, it's not tied in with the department?
No, oh yeah, it's separate and apart. And we, on workman's compensation, we have a commission administering that act. We got a damn good fish and game commission. We take good care of the fish and wildlife. Really no agency to look out for the working people.
When did that harassment end in the 60s? When did you see the end of that?
Good question.
Did it just kind of dribble off, or did it end abruptly?
Yeah, I'd say it just kind of dribbled off.
After the Voting Rights Act, when, 65, 66?
Trying to think now, just about when I would consider the period that it began to ease off some. The rough period was began in 60. Somewhere 64 was a rough son of a gun. I'd say around 67, 68 when it began to ease off some. Yeah.
When that ended. Could you believe at that time that in 2 years in 1970 you'd have this integration of the schools like you did?
No, sir. That's been one of the pleasant surprises out of the whole thing, is the fact that public education survived as well as it did.
To what do you attribute that?
Well,
to what do you attribute you had all those years of
mm-hmm.
the state's all the state was almost up in flames.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of years it appears to turn all the way around.
Well, you see, here's what we had in this state, and I told a gentleman that came in here one time, he wanted to, let's see, you probably know him.
Was it Neil Pierce?
No. His name will come in a minute. But anyhow, at that time, you know, even though we had a demagogue in the governor's office, we had some very good people in the superintendent of education, for instance. Very good, fine, outstanding people. Bill Winnett at that time, I believe, was state treasurer or something like that. Have you met Bill Winnett yet, the lieutenant governor? We had some very, very good people in the lower echelons of state government. And I say that Garvin Johnson, the present state superintendent of education, if we're going to give the credit to any single individual about bringing public education through this period of crisis, it would be him, because he was standing out front, you know, for public education all the way. And of course, you got another thing that a lot of people don't fully understand about the white Mississippian, and I think this applies to a lot of people in the South, even though they don't like a lot of damn things. Majority of them believe in abiding by the law. You know, I think that was a factor involved in this thing. You know, no way I can prove it, but I think it was. But I'll be honest with you about it. One of the most pleasant surprises out of this whole thing with me was the way the school situation eventually turned out. I think we come through it in a hell of a lot better shape than a lot of people did, don't you? What have you found in your round?
Well, the reason I ask you that is Mississippi was supposed to have more problems than anybody else.
Right.
Bring about massive integration.
At the top in the Department of Education, you know, stood tall. They all the way. And, you just put it all together. We just had enough good, solid people and positions of leadership that's across the board, you know, the labor movement, the whole works, even in the business community. that decided that this state had to maintain and preserve public education was going to ever, you know, get off a dead center and accomplish anything at all. It's really amazing when you look back at the Barnett era, when the White Citizen Council was dominating the state political situation. Those bastards were calling these shots in the governor's office. Hell, at one time, the damn state government helped finance the Citizen Council operation. You aware of that, aren't you?
No.
Yeah? Well, I'd suggest you talk to Bill Miner with the Times-Picayune if you haven't met Bill yet. He's been around the Capitol for a number of years, and he can give you a lot of background on this kind of stuff. Have you met Bill yet?
Yeah, we've talked to Bill.
Oh, you have? Well, have you queried him about some of this?
Not about that specifically.
Yeah.
You mean when there's financing the schools?
Yeah, well, financing the Citizen Council movement. Yeah, they're subsidizing the damn Citizen Council. And that's one thing, and I can't get down on this governor about completely here. You see, he vetoed a damn appropriation to keep this damn state sovereignty commission going last year. They cut off the fund. The state sovereignty commission was the segregationist watchdog agency, in case you want to know what it was, you know. Bill's been around the Capitol through all of this. He was on the scene before I came to Jackson as president of the state fair. And he's probably, I guess he would probably be not the most knowledgeable, at least one of the most knowledgeable people on a lot of these things we're talking about, you know.
Well, looking at the election returns in Mississippi in 1968 and in 72, in 68, white Mississippi was pretty much solid behind George Wallace, except a few votes Nixon got. And 72, Nixon got combined the two of them pretty much. I mean, his vote total was about equal to his and Wallace's vote in 68. Do you see that Wallace vote, or any substantial portion of it, particularly the blue-collar portion of the Wallace vote, coming back to the Democratic Party in national elections in Mississippi?
Yes, it'll happen sooner than a lot of people think. Again, I was talking to this group of young legislators about this last night. The Wallace thing is a little bit hard to understand. It's kind of a combination of populism and racism and a couple of other things, I guess. And again, you know, your start point, this whole thing is a good one in 48 for the state rights movement. That was the beginning of a lot of this thing. Now, you know, one of the things that's developing in the South and in Mississippi as in elsewhere is the development of a modified two-party system. You have to remember that we haven't had two political parties in the state up until recent years. The Republicans are beginning to the move, and they've elected a few candidates. They've got a couple of guys in the legislature and have had for several years now. Their candidate for the Senate against Jim Eastland polled, I think, about 40% of the vote the last time around. But this party politics, political situation, that is still in a period of confusion of sorts. People haven't yet settled down enough in national politics to start voting their economic interests, is what I'm trying to say, you know. But it's coming around. Yeah, I think it's just a matter of time now before.
Are they going to be doing that at the state level, too? Now that you've
there's really been more of it at the state level than at the national level. This is the thing that's a little bit hard to understand on occasion.
But hasn't it been race up and through 67 and maybe
right, 70? More or less. It's had racial overtones. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. I'd say you're right. Yeah.
But now that that's removed, you think the interest will focus on economic and the populist issues?
Right. I think so. I think so. But I think you look at the makeup. up the legislature now. The type of alignment of forces we've had in different areas to elect people to office. And I'd say yes, you know. It's still there in some areas. I can see undertones of it in the legislature every now and then. But that force doesn't dominate the legislature like it used to. Really doesn't. And I think we go through one more election. There'll be some more changes made. Our state legislature, if we could change, I'd say, maybe 8-10 faces in the House, maintain what we've got in the Senate, you see a lot of things happen over there. The committee set up in the House is where they get you. You know, I'm sure you're familiar with that arrangement. With a few ultra-conservatives controlling most of the major committee assignments, very easy for them to bear legislation on. You know, take the Department of Labor situation I was talking about a few minutes ago. We got enough votes in the House now to enact the State Department of Labor bill. The problem's getting it out of committee, getting a vote on it, you see.
What are the priorities insofar as labor is concerned, the legislative needs?
Well,
the Department of Labor number one?
Well, that, of course, naturally would be at the top of our list because we don't have a department. Of course, you know, we are very much concerned with education, and that's what we push to improve unemployment, to insurance, workman's compensation, because these issues directly affect the interests of working people. But education is really the key to many of our problems, you know. Therefore, we've concentrated a lot of our time in improving the educational institutions. And I think we were as responsible as any other group around and establishing an ETV system here in the state. I was told by a couple of members of the legislature I hadn't been first, that one went through. Now, I don't think that system's been developed as well as it ought to be. You know, as I visualized it at the time, ETV can be a real asset to public education and other institutions for that matter.
What's your relationship with the R&D Center?
Don't have any very much. I know the director of the R&D Center quite well. He and I confer from time to time, you know. I know the director of the ETV quite well. I've been on several of their programs, and we communicate quite regularly. But we don't have too much. I don't have too much communication with the R&D people on occasion.
What do you think of the center?
Well, I think, when I say what I think of the center, I think we have to talk about the whole setup, the NI board and the R&D center. We have to take it all together. I think we have thrown away a lot of money. A lot of money's going down the drain on these two operations. They ought to be integrated into one operation. The whole thing ought to be streamlined. I don't think I've really answered your question, but that's the situation as I see it.
You think the center is spending too much money, or the A&I board?
Well, I'm not real familiar with just what the R&D is spending, because a lot of the things they do, they're reimbursed for that. You know, it's not all state appropriations. The real waste, I think, is in there with the A&I board. Ready to do. But you can find other people that's more knowledgeable on that than I am, you know.
But the Federation doesn't have a position in relationship to that.
Right.
Are you co-director as well as AFL-CIO?
No, we've got two full-time officers, Secretary of Treasurer and myself, and the Secretary is a co-director, Tom Knight.
What's his name?
Tom Knight.
Tom Knight.
Mm-hmm. He and I have both been in office about the same time. He was elected, I think, a year after I was.
Do you have a newspaper or a newsletter on a regular basis.
We got a newsletter, a bulletin that we get out pretty regular to the affiliated organizations. It's similar to the Alabama newsletter. Some of the others you've seen, you know.
Are you hooking into this computer system?
Not yet.
You going to?
Well, we might later on. We we've talked to him. You're talking about the thing in Washington,
right?
Aren't you? The that's what I thought you was talking about. Our organization is really not big enough. We don't have the membership to justify getting tied in with it. We're doing about all of the same things they're doing with a computer set up with our dress grab system already. We can do many things with that that we couldn't do if we was on the computer. We do a hell of a lot of mailings for our local unions, and in order to do that, we have to maintain an up-to-date mailing list in the office. If we had everything on that computer in Washington, it would, take a week or 10 days to get your dresses in here to, get everything together. But I suspect we'll eventually get on the thing. I think everybody will before it's all over with, you know.
Do you know what percentage of your members are registered?
Don't have any recent figures on that. Just trying to think. The last time we actually had a check on it, I remember right up to around 65% at that time. That was pretty good. See, there's one thing we've got in the state that you don't have in some states, and that's permanent restoration. Once we get them on the rolls, they stay there unless they move or die or something, and purge. That's one advantage we've had once we've got the people
except,
on the
except road. Isn't there a provision that local registrars can order re-registration?
Well, not the law. The boards of supervisors, under certain conditions, can...